KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Welcome to Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. We human beings have wondered how our brains work for millennia, and we haven't been afraid to knock around in there to find out. There is evidence that trepanation, the surgical practice of drilling a hole into the skull in order to cure headaches or mental disorders, was performed in Neolithic times, just at the tail end of the Stone Age. Ouch! Despite all that early head tapping, the brain continued to be misunderstood for centuries. Aristotle and many other early scientists believed the heart was the center of human intelligence. This view was generally accepted until the Greek physician Galen, circa the 2nd century AD, doctor to Roman gladiators, observed that his patients lost their mental faculties when they had sustained damage to their brains. According to author Sam Keane, the stories of people who survived terrible brain disease and injury are at the heart of how modern neuroscience advanced. His latest book is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. In it, he presents many forgotten tales of the people who helped us understand how the brain works. Sam Keane is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, Slate, and New Scientist. His previous books include The Disappearing Spoon and The Violinist's Thumb. Sam Keane spoke at Town Hall Seattle on May 20th, 2014. Thanks to Ayan Sheikh for this recording.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you all for joining me tonight. So people often want to know what inspired a book. And I can say with this book, what inspired me was doubt. Disbelief, skepticism, mistrust, whatever you want to call it. Because a few years ago, I was reading in another book about someone who suffered a brain injury. And after he suffered the injury, his behavior changed sort of dramatically as a result. And I was reading about this, and I just said to myself, you know, bull sugar. I said, there is no way that this story is true. I do not believe that at all. But I forgot about it, and you know, for a few days, didn't think about it again until I was reading something else. Coincidentally, it mentioned someone else with a brain injury. Their behavior changed again afterward. And again, I said to myself, baloney. I said, there is no way that that can possibly be true. I mean, I write about a lot of sort of strange and unusual science things, but this seemed too outlandish, too strange. So this book came about because I wanted to sort of disprove these stories. I wanted to get to the bottom of what was going on. So what kind of stories am I talking about? I think we've all heard stories of people who have been injured in the brain and then they maybe lose the ability to speak, or half their body is paralyzed, or their memory goes on the blink, something like that. So it wasn't stories like that that really bothered me. It was stories about people losing something startlingly specific. The really, really specific things were the things that I just didn't believe. For example, I think we all generally know what kind of animals we're looking at in this picture here. But if a spot in the temporal lobe on the side of your brain, if a very specific spot in the temporal lobe gets nicked, all of a sudden, some people lose all ability to recognize animals whatsoever. So dogs, cats, elephants, raccoons, all of those things look exactly the same to them. They cannot tell them apart. Plants, they can tell apart just fine. Faces, they can tell apart. Human-made objects, things like that are okay. But animals and animals alone, they cannot tell apart. Or sort of the opposite happens to other people. Again, I think we all generally know what kind of plants these are here. But if another spot in the temporal lobe gets nicked, all knowledge of plants will just evaporate out of your head. You won't be able to tell carrots from peas, from pineapples, from trees, anything like that. Just all disappears. And so when I was thinking about this, I realized that it actually provides kind of an interesting insight into how the brain evolved. Because way back when, when our ancestors were running around the wilderness, some of them were good at recognizing animals, recognizing plants. And that gave whoever was good at recognizing those things kind of an advantage because they could tell, you know, which animals were possible prey, which were possible predators, which were good as beasts of burden, things like that. or for plants, which were good to eat, which were poisonous, which might be medicine. So being able to recognize different types of animals and plants gave you an advantage. And eventually that ability sort of got hardwired into our brain as kind of a circuit for recognizing animals or plants. But the danger of having specialized circuitry is that if that circuitry gets injured, that whole class of things will just poof, go right from your brain. And that's what happened in these cases. There was another example, the second thing that I came across that I thought was even stranger and more unusual. Again, we probably all heard stories of people suffering a stroke or something and losing the ability to speak. But there are some cases where something unusual happens. Sometimes a stroke can damage the actual language centers in the brain. But sometimes the stroke leaves the language centers okay, but it just damages the connections between the language centers and, say, your mouth. So it's like a computer that's unplugged. You know, the computer might be okay, but if it can't connect to other things, then it's much less useful. That's what happened here. The connections were getting broken. Excuse me. But one thing you learn about studying the brain is that there are actually a lot of back alleys, a lot of alternative connections between one part of the brain and another part of the brain. So, for instance, there are connections that run from the language centers into the emotional parts of your brain and then down to your mouth. So if you're talking with someone where the direct connection is broken, but sort of this alternative loop is still in existence, something kind of funny can happen. Because if you try to talk to them, they won't be able to respond to you. But if you provoke them, if you get them angry, if you really rile them up, they might be able to swear at you. So they'll look at you and they'll say, "You beepity beep beep," and then they'll put their hands over their mouth because, you know, they're embarrassed, first of all. But second of all, they didn't realize they could swear either. It just sort of bubbled up inside them unconsciously. They didn't realize they could do it, but there are people out there who cannot speak. But if you provoke them, they'll start to swear. Along these same lines, there are people where the connections between there's still a connection between the language center, the musical parts of the brain, and the mouth. So these people, again, can't speak, but they can still sing. Gabrielle Giffords, for instance, the congresswoman from Arizona, when she got shot in the head, she lost the ability to speak for a while, but she was able to sing. She was singing songs like "Girls Just Want to Have Fun." I don't know why that was the song that she was able to sing, but she was still able to sing that song. And eventually she kind of retrained herself to be able to speak by doing things like singing over and over, getting that practice, forming words. So again, there people cannot speak, but they can still sing sometimes. And while I was kind of contemplating all of these sorts of stories one day, I realized that they're not just anecdotes. They really provide an insight into how the brain works, how it's organized, how it's put together, all of these sorts of things. And I was kind of daydreaming about this, and I just thought, boy, you know, I bet you could write a whole history of how the brain works just based on different parts of it getting injured. And then sort of the cartoon light bulb went off over my head, and I said, oh boy, I should write a book about that. That would be a lot of fun. So that's where this book came from, is these few stories about people losing very specific abilities but retaining others, and, you know, their mind changed in sort of an unusual way. Really, until the past few decades, there was only one way for neuroscientists to study the brain, and that was to wait for disaster to strike people and see how their minds worked differently afterwards. Sometimes these were tumors or gunshots, botched lobotomies, rabies infections, all different sorts of things. And in some cases, the fact that people survived was really a miracle. But if people's bodies survived, their minds didn't, not quite. There was always something a little off or a little unusual about their minds. Some people lost all fear of death. Other people would start lying incessantly. Parents suddenly couldn't recognize their children anymore. But each case really offered an important clue about what that injured area of the brain did. And virtually all major discoveries in the history of neuroscience came about this way, through injuries. Stories are probably more important to neuroscience than maybe any other scientific field out there. So I'm happy to be able to share a few of those stories with you tonight. So I thought I would start with something kind of visceral, with emotions. When you're talking about emotions in the brain, you're talking about the limbic system. So I'll give you a quick overview of what the limbic system is like. So here's something that might give you an emotion, a big tiger jumping in front of you in the jungle. So what would happen if the tiger jumped in front of you? Just briefly, here are some structures involved with emotions in the brain. So this information about the tiger would come in through your eyes and your ears, and it would go to the center of the brain, an area called the thalamus, right there in the middle in yellow. What the thalamus is a relay center. So it takes information in from your sensory equipment and kind of relays it to different parts of the brain. One of these streams of information goes into what's called the hippocampus. Hippocampus is very involved in forming memories. And we'll talk a little bit more about the hippocampus later, but again, it's just involved with forming memories, kind of drawing them up, forming new memories, things like that. Another stream of information goes into what's called the amygdala. The amygdala is involved in processing lots of different emotions, but it's especially involved in processing fear. And it's the amygdala's decision about whether we should care about something. So in this case, the amygdala would look at the tiger in front of you, and it would say, okay, well, it has big teeth, growling, it's kind of muscular, it's maybe running at me at this point. It's probably something I should care about. What the amygdala does is it gives a kick to the hypothalamus, which is one of the real busy beavers in the body because it's sort of the interface between the brain and the body. The hypothalamus is what will sort of give you that fight or flight response. It will make you, you know, tense up, get ready to fight, make you run away. So it basically judges what the emotion is and decides what to do. So in general, that's just basically how the emotions work in the brain. It comes in through sensory equipment, brain processes it a little bit, and then it goes to the hypothalamus and our bodies do something. But sometimes that process can go awry. And the first case I'm going to look at tonight is a case where it did go awry. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here. So this story involves a woman named SM. That's how she's known in the medical literature. But I'm going to call her Sarah. So Sarah was born in the 1960s in Iowa. And when she was growing up, she had a perfectly normal fear response to most things. There was an example she talked about later of being cornered in her neighbor's house by a Doberman. The Doberman was barking at her. She felt her stomach lurch. She felt her heart pounding, sort of a typical fear response. Another time, her brother lured her into a graveyard at midnight, and then he kind of snuck away and hid behind a tombstone and jumped out and scared her. She screamed, started running around, you know, basically a typical fear response once again. But when she was about 9 or 10 years old, Sarah came down with a rare disease that started destroying the cells in her amygdala inside her brain. And eventually she was left with what her doctors described as two black holes where her amygdala should be. And basically, after that point, Sarah has not felt a lick of fear in her life. And when you read about scientific studies of Sarah, they're actually kind of a hoot to read about because they basically consist of scientists trying to dream up ever more elaborate ways to frighten her. So, for instance, one time they decided to drive her to an exotic pet store to see a bunch of snakes. In the ride over, Sarah was saying, you know, I don't really know that I like snakes that much. I'm just not that into snakes. But as soon as she got there, practically jumped out of the car, ran in the door, grabbed the snakes out of the clerk's hand, and was playing with them. You know, she was petting them. She kept asking if she could pet the venomous snakes they had behind the glass. She was looking at them, and she kept trying to grab the snakes' tongues as they would flick at her. And I'm no reptile expert, but I'm pretty sure snakes do not like having their tongue grabbed like that. They did not respond well to this, but Sarah didn't care. She was just really fascinated by these snakes. Another time, scientists brought her to this haunted house. It was in an old lunatic asylum, so plenty of shadowy corners, creaking doors and floorboards, things like that. And they paired Sarah up with five other people and had them go through this haunted house. The other people were kind of like a control group. And, you know, Sarah, the other people were just screaming, you know, covering their eyes, things like that. But Sarah didn't care. She was always running ahead to see what was next, sticking her head where it shouldn't have been, things like that. And eventually, toward the end of the haunted house, this monster jumped out of a corner. It was an actor in a costume, obviously. But this monster jumped out and waved its arms at Sarah. And Sarah didn't blink. She didn't really care. But she was looking at the monster. And she got kind of curious because it had this mask with kind of some gore and blood on it, and she wanted to know what the mask felt like. So she walked up to the monster, and she lunged at the monster. And she ended up scaring the monster because he didn't expect to be sort of assaulted in this haunted house like this. But These were the kind of things Sarah would do. She was incapable of feeling any sort of fear. But, you know, these were good, sober scientists, and they knew that this was probably her lack of fear was probably related to her amygdala damage. But they wanted to investigate further to see what exactly was going on. One thing they wanted to examine was whether she was blunted to all emotion. Maybe she just couldn't feel anything. So it wasn't necessarily that she couldn't feel fear as much as she just wasn't experiencing any emotions. So they started playing movie clips for her one day in the lab. But it turns out Sarah could feel other emotions just fine. She felt happy at the right times, felt sad at the right times, disgusted, angry, all sorts of things. It was only fear that she couldn't feel. So again, this was a good example, or I should say the insight that this gave us was that other emotions, even though they're often processed by the amygdala, can kind of bypass the amygdala. They can take an alternative route around the amygdala, and you can still feel these other emotions. But fear, for whatever reason, needs to go through the amygdala. You really need an amygdala to feel this kind of fear that Sarah should have been feeling. So that was a good insight that it sort of confirmed the fact that the amygdala really is tied up very deeply with fear.
Stay tuned for more about Sarah and other curious examples of neuroscientific discoveries with writer Sam Keen. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
22 minutes past 9, 94.9 KUOW. An ex-prize fighter faces a crushing dilemma. Should he rat out a corrupt union boss or keep silent while others suffer? It's an iconic story of corruption and redemption. Yes, On the Waterfront by Bud Schulberg, adapted for the stage and produced by LA Theater Works. That's tomorrow night at 10. That show, by the way, includes an interview with author Bud Schulberg, recorded in 2002. LA Theater Works tomorrow night at 10. Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, where families can discover the answers to interesting questions about Puget Sound marine life, like, why does an octopus have three hearts? Learn more about the Seattle Aquarium and its commitment to clean, healthy ocean waters at seattleaquarium.org.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Let's get back to the story of Sarah and the question of what fear really is.
Another thing the scientists wanted to explore was how this kind of played out in Sarah's everyday life. Because, you know, going to the haunted house, she really wasn't in any danger there. Nothing bad was going to happen to her. Even at the snake store, there were other people around, there were experts. There really wasn't much of a chance that something bad was going to happen. So they wanted to say, well, is she ever, missing fear in her daily life? They found out that there were some instances, including what I call the knife incident. So Sarah was walking home alone one day in the dark, already a bad idea, and she decided to cut through this unlit park behind a church. So she was walking through this, and she saw a man kind of off to the side lying on a bench. And the man looked drugged out, she later said. But the man called out to her and said, hey, come over here. So Sarah said, okay, sounds good. So she walked right over to this man who jumped up. He had a knife and flipped her around and put the knife to her throat. So he was going to attack her. And they later asked Sarah what she was experiencing at this moment, what she was feeling. And Sarah later remembered thinking that, well, you know, this was kind of inconvenient that this guy had done this to her. And she was kind of angry, too. She didn't like this. But she didn't feel any fear. It never occurred to her, and she never felt any fear bubbling up inside her. So she sat there for a moment after the man said something to her, and she said, God's angels will protect me. And at this point, the man got a little weirded out. So he kind of withdrew his knife. So Sarah was free now, but instead of jumping up and running away, she just kind of brushed herself off and just walked away, just kept going through the park. Next day, she was right back in the park. So nothing could make this woman feel fear, even having her life on the line like this. And the really big insight, I think, into this whole situation with Sarah is that fear is really two steps. There's two steps involved in feeling fear. There's the point where we see something that we should be afraid of, and we lock our attention onto it. And then there's the part where we actually feel fear, where we want to run away or attack it or do something like that. And, you know, that makes sense. If you're out in the jungle and you see a snake or something on the ground, you want to lock your attention onto the snake. You don't want to lose track of the snake and, you know, start looking at the clouds or a monkey or something while the snake's moving toward you. You want to fix your attention onto the snake. And Sarah was able to experience the first of these two steps. Because when she was at the snake store, for instance, she didn't, you know, wasn't just indifferent to the snakes. She was fascinated by the snake. She was staring at the snake. She loved the snakes. Same thing in the haunted house. She wasn't indifferent to the monster. She ran up to the monster. She wanted to see what the monster's mask was made of. The man in the park, she was fascinated. She locked her attention onto those things. Problem was, Sarah, because of her brain damage, couldn't take the second step and actually feel the fear that would make her get the heck out of there. So in most of us, we do experience these two steps, but they happen so quickly, one right after the other, that we can't really tease them apart. It was really Sarah who allowed scientists to tease these two steps apart because she was only taking the first step, not the second step. So again, it's a really important insight into how fear works in the brain. That's really a two-step process. But I think there's even kind of a bigger insight that we could get into the way our brain works based on Sarah. You know, you could justly criticize this the work on Sarah by saying, well, you know, they said she had two black holes in her brain, but reading about some of these things maybe sounds like kind of she had a hole in her head. Like she maybe didn't have a whole lot of common sense when it comes to a lot of these situations. So maybe that was actually her big problem. But I think that kind of misses the point, which is that when it comes to fear, when it comes to keeping us out of dangerous situations, fear really is common sense. Fear is what bestows common sense on us in the first place. You know, normally we think about our rational brain as kind of being in charge of what we're doing. But one of the big themes of neuroscience in the past few decades is that our unconscious brain, things like emotions, are really driving a lot of our actions. I heard a scientist talk about a metaphor once that I thought was really, really good, really helpful. And he compared the brain to a man riding on top of an elephant. So this man riding on top of the elephant is kind of trying to steer the elephant, make him go left, go right. He's hitting him with a switch, you know, saying ha, left, right, things like that. And the man on top of the elephant thinks that he's in charge. You know, he really thinks that he's directing this elephant to go left and right. But we all know if that elephant wanted to go right instead of left or whatever, the elephant is going to go left. This puny little man on top of the elephant is not going to stop the elephant from doing what it wants to do. And our brain is a lot like that. We do have a rational part of our brain that's on top of the unconscious parts. And it is doing something. But the unconscious part, I don't think we give credence to how important it is, to how much it's driving our actions. And Sarah was a really clear example of this because the unconscious part of her was really driving a lot of what she was doing. And when it comes to keeping us alive, again, fear really is the common sense. And without fear, Sarah wasn't behaving rationally. That's kind of the opposite of the way we usually think about it. We usually think about fear, emotions, things like that, as interfering with reason, as kind of disrupting our reason. But in this case, emotions aren't what is disrupting our reason. They're really making us behave rationally in the first place. And it's a very important insight that that emotions and our rationality really do work together. Because we call ourselves Homo sapiens, the thinking ape, the wise ape, but we're feeling apes as well. And you really need both of those things. You need the emotion and you need the rationality to be fully human. So that first story, again, examined emotion, something kind of visceral, bodily inside of us. For the next part of the talk, I'm going to kind of jump to the highest level of the human brain and start to talk about consciousness, kind of the summa of the human brain. But once again, our consciousness is based in our brain circuits. And if those brain circuits go awry, get damaged, something like that, our consciousness can go on the blink. I'm actually going to look at two stories that examine consciousness from slightly different angles. So the first story involves this man right here, a man named Clive Wearing. He was a classical musician in London in the late 70s, early 80s, very, very well known, very prominent, when the BBC needed to do a broadcast of Charles and Diana's wedding, for instance. Clive is the person they called on to do the score for that. So again, very well known, very prominent. But about 1985, he came down with the flu one week, and he got hit pretty hard by it. Doctor visited his flat and said, okay, get some rest, take some fluids, kind of the typical things you do for a flu. But he just wasn't getting any better. He started feeling really lethargic. He was getting confused as well. He went outside one day, for instance, wandered around, got into a taxi, couldn't remember his address. The taxi had to drop him off at a police station. His wife had to come get him. Things were getting pretty serious here. Eventually, they got him in to the hospital, and they realized that he didn't have the flu. He actually had an infection inside his brain. He had an infection of what's called the herpes virus. This wasn't the STD, but it was the virus that causes cold sores. So if you've ever had a cold sore, it's the same virus. And I don't mean to panic people, because it's pretty rare for this to happen. But every so often, it is the case that the herpes virus in a cold sore will go rogue. It will start to migrate up the olfactory nerve, the smell nerve, from your nose up into your brain. And once it gets there, it starts wreaking havoc. It really does a lot of damage in the brain. The people I mentioned at the beginning of the program who couldn't recognize animals and plants, they also had herpes virus damage in their brains. Clive had a little different structures damaged inside his brain. It was pretty widespread, all of the damage. It was in his parietal lobe, his frontal lobe, and his temporal lobe, kind of all over. In particular, the one thing he had damaged was his hippocampus, which I mentioned earlier is very involved with forming and storing memories. So Clive woke up as an amnesiac. And, you know, we've all seen probably TV shows or something with people who have amnesia. And real-life people with amnesia aren't like that. They can still, you know, remember their name, who they are, things like that. And they still have some motor memory. So they can sign their name, for instance, ride a bicycle. They might even retain a few slivers of memory from very early in their life. For instance, they might remember the rules to a card game that they love playing, something like that. But for the most part, Clive's memories were completely wiped out, and he couldn't form any new memories going forward. So you always had to tell him where the bathroom was. You had to reintroduce yourself every single time you saw him, things like that. And in fact, Clive had the most profound case of amnesia that the medical world has ever seen. They have never seen a worse case than they saw in Clive Wearing. For instance, he would be playing solitaire. Excuse me. And he would blink, and the cards would seem to have rearranged themselves because his memory couldn't last from the beginning of a blink to the end of a blink. That is how short-term his memory was. Or he'd be looking at someone with a green shirt on, maybe, and he would turn his head, and he would look back, and their shirt would have seemed to have changed color because his memories couldn't last any longer than his sensory perceptions did. So again, the most profound case of amnesia the world has ever seen. And in the book, I talk a little bit more about what it's like to live with this, what it's like to be this person day to day. But right now, I'm going to focus on something a little different, something kind of strange that happened as a result of this amnesia. One symptom that they found pretty early in Clive was that he lost all sense of continuity. So he didn't have a good idea that the past existed because he would sort of be there at any one moment, and it would feel like he'd never had a past at all. So to him, every moment was like the first moment he'd ever been awake, the first moment he'd ever been conscious in his life. And again, it sounds sort of odd, but that's the way it felt to Clive over and over, that right now, this moment was the first moment I've ever been conscious. And to be clear, it's not like he was actually, you know, falling asleep or going unconscious over and over. It's just that with the evidence available to him and how it felt in his own brain, every moment was like the first moment of consciousness. I'm finally awake for the first time, he kept saying. And in fact, as you can imagine, if you were to suddenly become conscious for the very first time, it would be a very exciting, very interesting moment for you. And he got so excited about these, he would actually grab his diary and he would record the moment in his diary over and over. He would say, 8:31, I am really completely awake. 9:06, I am perfectly, overwhelmingly awake. 9:34, I'm superlatively, actually awake. He was very good with adverbs, Clive. So he kept doing this over and over and over. And if he didn't have his diary at hand, he would grab a pen and he would write on the furniture. He would write on the wall. He just wanted to record this amazing moment of being conscious for the first time. But as you can see there, there's a lot of scribble marks on the page. And that's because every time Clive would pick up his diary, he would read the old entry and he would say, well, you know, that's clearly false because now is the first time I'm awake. So he would cross the old entry out. He would write the new entry. 20 minutes later, same thing would happen. He would pick up his diary. He would say, well, that's clearly false because now I'm awake for the first time. Cross the old entry out and write the new one. Clive has dozens of diaries just littered with pages like this where he's just saying he's conscious for the first time over and over and crossing the old entries out. Whole pages just stricken out like this. So the big question then is, why is this happening to Clive? Why does he feel his consciousness sort of bubbling up inside him over and over and over? Because it's not something that happens to normal people with amnesia. Normal amnesiacs cannot remember their past, obviously. But they don't feel this sort of disconnect between the past and the present. They know it's just something they can't remember. Whereas Clive, his consciousness was going on the blink, sort of blinking on and off over and over and over. And the answer is we don't quite know what exactly is going on, why this is happening in Clive. But we do have a few important insights. And probably the biggest insight is that it's something about the combination of damage throughout Clive's brain. Because they've never seen a case like this. So they know it's not the case that just one little part of the brain got damaged and then his consciousness went on the blink. Because they would have seen other people with similar symptoms before if it was just one part of the brain that could get damaged and your consciousness would go awry. So again, it's something about the unique combination of damage in Clive's brain, with his temporal lobe, with his limbic system, with his frontal lobes. It's a combination of lots and lots of things. And cases like Clive help us make a strong argument, as a neuroscientist might say, that consciousness isn't a thing in a place. It's a process in a population. So it's not a thing in a place because there's not one little consciousness node in your brain that can go on the blink. Consciousness involves all parts of your brain working together. And though we don't know exactly what's going on with Clive, it's something about the whole ensemble that's giving him these problems. So an important insight into how consciousness works. I'm going to come back to Clive in a moment, but I'm going to look now at another case of consciousness kind of going on the blink. This case involves a woman who was in around Vancouver about 2005. She found out she was pregnant. So she was very excited, went to the doctor, started getting ultrasounds, things like that. But they found some bad news. And that was that the twins she was going to have, as she found out, were conjoined, what used to be called Siamese twins. And so she brought them to term and decided she was, you know, going to raise them. And it turns out that they were conjoined at the head. So they kind of share some structures inside of their brain. And the girls are healthy, normal, happy girls. So it worked out okay for them. You know, they're pretty normal girls overall. But because of their brain being connected like this, they do show some unusual behavior. Specifically, the part of their brain that is connected is the thalamus. And I mentioned the thalamus before as the relay center inside the brain. So it takes sensory information from your eyes, ears, things like that, and it relays it to different parts of the brain. So because the two girls share a thalamus, they also share a lot of sensory input. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if one girl takes a sip of juice out of her cup, the other girl can taste the juice in her mouth. Or one of the girls might go to the doctor, get a vaccine, the other girl will feel the prick in her arm. They fall asleep together. They maybe even dream together. There was one moment where someone observed them at a fast food restaurant. And, you know, they're kids, they're siblings. They get into fights sometimes. So they were calling each other names. They were pushing each other. Finally, one of the girls reached up, slapped the other girl in the face, then immediately grabbed her own face in pain because it hurt her. So a lesson maybe all kids should have learned very early on. Don't hit people. But, you know, this, as they're getting older, they're really providing a lot of fascinating insights into the way their brains work together like this. So the big obvious question then is, well, are they one person or are they two people? Because they're sharing sensory input, so in some way they're kind of sharing a consciousness. Does that make them one person or are they two separate people? And it's always a little, it's always, I think, going to be a little ambiguous, a little tricky, but I think most of the evidence points to them being two separate individuals. For instance, they sometimes just say to people out of the blue, I am just me. They'll just walk up to someone and say that. I am just me. You know, kind of asserting their own personal identity. They also have distinct likes and dislikes and tastes. One of the girls, for instance, likes ketchup. She loves ketchup on her fries and her hot dogs, things like that. Unfortunately, her sister does not like ketchup, so she's constantly scraping it off her tongue when her sister eats it. And, you know, it's, again, kind of an amusing anecdote, but it shows that they do have distinct likes and dislikes. They are separate in that way. Even the kind of Three Stooges moment where one girl reached up and slapped the other girl in the face, even that moment, I think, provides some insight because you don't slap yourself when you're in a fight. When you just react and get angry, you hit another person. That's your instinct. So something apparently inside of each of one of them is defining the other sister as a distinct person. So that's really an interesting idea, that you can share some aspects of consciousness with another person, but you're going to retain your own personal identity. And to circle back to Clive, you can kind of see these same things in Clive as well. Again, his consciousness was on the blink, but he never lost a sense of who he was deep inside of himself. For instance, one of the things that Clive retained was the ability to play music. He could sit down and he could sight read music perfectly well because that's a motor memory. So it was part of his brain that was not affected. So he could play music. But something kind of unusual happened because whenever he was playing music, he suddenly felt like himself again. Something about the momentum of the music, the phrasing, the way it's similar from beginning to end, it sort of gave him a coherence that he otherwise lacked. He was somehow able to tap into himself, his old self, deep down for whatever reason. Very similarly, he never lost the love that he had for his wife. He married Deborah when they were, or excuse me, I should say that he came down with his illness when he and Deborah were newlywed. So he never kind of got over that kind of fawning newlywed phase. So whenever Deborah visits him today, he jumps up and down for joy and says, "Deborah, Deborah, I love you, I love you. Why do you never, ever visit me?" And, you know, she visits him almost every day. And she maybe will put her bag down, say, "Hello, Clive, I love you too," go to the bathroom, come back, and Clive will jump up again and say, "Deborah, Deborah, I love you, I love you. Why do you never visit me?" And, you know, Deborah admits sometimes it gets a little hard to fake the enthusiasm for the 10,000th time. But in another way, it really is touching because his love for his wife is something that will never abandon him and that he will never abandon. It's part of his core inner self, and it's something that's never going to go away. So the big lesson from these stories about consciousness, I think, is that your sense of self remains intact. And again, we often think about our consciousness as ourselves. We kind of equate our consciousness with ourselves. But in fact, you can share consciousness with someone and retain your own personal identity. Your consciousness can go on the blink, but you're still going to remember who you are deep down. And I think actually there's something reassuring in that. The book covers a lot of stories from people from all walks of life. There's stories about Dostoevsky and why he would see flashes of God before him, about Woodrow Wilson and some of the neurological disorders he suffered from while he was in office, about Phineas Gage, the railroad worker who had that huge spike blown through the top of his head, probably the most maligned man in medical history. But in most cases, the victims of these injuries were everyday people. They were people just like you, just like me, who had very bad luck to get an injury and to have it in part of the brain that really changed their behavior. And what happened to them could have happened to any one of us. And again, because of their accidents, their minds don't quite work like ours. But the real power of stories is that we can reach across that divide that separates us, because we can look at their entire lives. We can look at the whole context of their lives. And the more you look at these stories, the more you realize that, well, even though they had these kind of strange deficits, for the most part, their brains still work like ours did. Most people could still talk and walk and emote. They could still reason. A lot of people could still remember certain things, even if they forgot other things. And even more importantly than that, they still suffered the same disappointments that we do. They felt the same joys that we do, the same bewilderment that life maybe kind of got away from them. And above all, they retained a personal, deep down sense of self. That sense of self is very tenacious, something very, very hard to get rid of. And there's almost nothing you can do to the brain that will eject that. You will retain that sense of self. So there's a lot of tales of injury and woe in the book. But even deeper than that, there's a lot of resiliency in the book. The brain's a really amazing organ in its ways, in its abilities to compensate for deficits, in order to heal itself, do things like that. And I think seeing this resiliency simply requires us to change our focus a little bit. It's a lot like an optical illusion, where you can focus on one part of the picture and see one thing. You can focus on the bizarre deficits if you want. But if you change your focus, you'll see that a lot of these tales about bizarre deficits are really tales about courage and resiliency and persistence instead, the brain's ability to heal itself. That's really how the book builds from beginning to end, as you see this progress with a lot of different people as their brains do learn to heal themselves. As I said before, stories probably mean more to neuroscience than any other scientific field out there. And above all, they help us understand what it means to be truly human. So I'm happy as I was able to share a few of those stories with you tonight. So again, thank you all for coming.
You're tuned to Speakers Forum with this week's guest, science writer Sam Keen. We'll go to questions from the town hall audience after a quick break. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
12 minutes before 10 o'clock, KUOW 94.9. Confessions from Star Trek The Next Generation star and geek king Will Wheaton, also versifying from poet Kevin Young, and music from 3/5 of the Decemberists, a group known as Black Prairie All, recorded with a live audience in Portland, Oregon. That's Live Wire Radio, tomorrow evening at 8. The forecast for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 60, partly cloudy, chance of thunderstorms. Friday highs lower to mid-80s, partly sunny, chance of thunderstorms. Support for KUOW comes from Bumbershoot, the last 3 days of summer, where one ticket provides access to more than 100 acts of music, comedy, film, and more. Full schedule and ticket information at bumbershoot.org.
Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you're looking for a good summer read, NPR book critic Michael Schaub calls the dueling neurosurgeons perfect for summer readers who prefer some substance with their fun. Now, back to Sam Keen for questions from the audience.
And now I'm happy to take questions if you come up to the microphones.
So how about the opposite phenomena where people have something happened to him, and all of a sudden they become savants in, you know, some music or mathematics or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, I do talk about that a little bit in the book. And that's pretty rare for you to get injured in some sort of, new talent to come out. But there are cases where it does happen. For instance, there are people who are damaged in the left side of the brain, which is usually the dominant side of the brain. And you can kind of take those left-right differences a little too far, but it is true in general that the left side's a little more logical, rational, a little more dominant. The right side's a little more arty. And if the left side does get damaged, sometimes talents will come out in the right brain. People, you know, who never cared about poetry before might find themselves suddenly fascinated with poetry, or they might suddenly be obsessed with painting and want to paint for the first time in their life. So there are cases where that would happen, where you get an injury, and it might not be beneficial overall, but talents sometimes do sort of bubble up to the surface like that.
Hi. I had a question about the conjoined twins. So
yeah.
Was it just sensory that they matched on, or other things like personality, emotion? Could one be really happy and one be really sad? And how old are they now, and have they learned anything else in the last few years?
Okay, so they were born in 2005, so they're 8, 9 years old at this point. They've done some studies on them, but they're a little too young to really do a whole lot. They're just kind of letting them grow up as normal children. So I think in the future we're going to see a little bit more than that. And I do think they do share some emotions, because part of an emotion is what you're feeling in your body. So if you're feeling, you know, scared or trembling or something like that, that's a sensory that's a sensory sensation, I guess. And you're going to be able to feel that. So if one girl does feel something like that, the other one should be able to feel that as well. So,
thank you.
No problem.
Hi, I was curious, did Clive remember his diary, that he had a diary? Was that, you mentioned that he had written in mm-hmm. his diary several times that he was alive and excited to be alive.
Yeah, doing the diary was something he had been doing for a while, I think, before that. So it was one of the things that just came through, sort of like the rules to solitaire did, where it just happened to be one of those things that came through, that he knew he wrote a diary, he knew he was a musician. So a few of these kind of spot things came through after his amnesia, and that just happened to be one of them. One of the real distinctions you learn about in memory research is between what they call semantic memories, so memories of, you know, names, dates, facts, things like that, and personal memories, memories of what you actually experienced, what you actually felt and saw. And in a lot of cases, your semantic memories might remain intact. So you might know, you know, what you got for Christmas one year, but you're not going to remember how excited you were, something like that. So some of those things, those kind of semantic things, did come across in Clive, or sort of, I guess, cross the bridge between the before and after.
Okay, thanks.
Hi. I was wondering if you did any research into hemispherectomies, and the reason I ask is because my partner, who is here tonight, had a hemispherectomy when mm-hmm. he was 11 years old.
Yeah, I do talk a little bit in the book about a hemispherectomy, basically you remove an entire hemisphere of the brain. And people can recover from that, usually if it's done young. You said he was 11. So if you do it young enough, you can recover from that. So I talk about hemispherectomies some, and also a very unusual class of patients called split brain patients. So basically you have a structure running right down the center of your brain called the corpus callosum that connects the two hemispheres. It's like a bunch of wires connecting them. And sometimes to control epilepsy, they just cut it right down the middle. And in some ways, these people kind of have two independent brains running inside their head. They can draw different figures with their left and right hand. And they really gave a lot of fascinating insights into how the brain works. So, yep. So we'll go here. And then, yep.
I was curious about whether you'd done any analysis of some of the neuroplasticity and the, you know, the kind of new science that is, and kind of the evolution of that evolved from phantom limb. I think it was Ramachandra or somebody. Mm-hmm. Did you look at any of that?
Yeah, I do look at both neuroplasticity in general and phantom limbs in particular. The phantom limb story is kind of rooted in our Civil War. That's the real time where they had enough cases of phantom limbs to really figure out what was going on. And then kind of the research, how that's progressed over the past about 150 years or so, as we learned more and more, and how neuroplasticity, which is basically the brain's ability to rewire itself, how that plays into it, and some of the explanations for things like not only phantom limbs, but, you know, people recovering from strokes, kind of regaining the ability to speak, to walk, things like that, because of neuroplasticity. Can you, the microphone?
You're retraining, right? That's why I was curious, mm-hmm. based on what you said. So based on that phantom limb science, right, that they found that there was, maybe there was a part of the brain that resided over a particular function that now wasn't being stimulated because you lost the limb.
Yeah, so basically your brain, different parts of your brain control different parts of your body, and when you lose a limb, you know, if you imagine a big map of the United States at night, you could see, you know, lights all over. Imagine Chicago just disappearing, this big blank spot suddenly in the middle of your brain. That's what happens when you lose a limb, is there's this big blank spot in the middle of your brain. And so in the book, I talk about some of the consequences of that and then how you can kind of get that part back online again.
Okay, then. Thanks.
Yep.
Fantastic book.
Thank you.
It, both in terms of content and in terms of how well it's written. For those of us who have read your earlier books, that's not a surprise at all.
Thank you.
Fantastic job, seriously. So I'm a psychologist, mm-hmm. and I was familiar with many of the characters in the book, some of the principal characters, but the lens that you bring to them really brings them alive. So I really appreciate that. So one question I have is, what in your research, what was the one story that stood out where you just said, wait, what? And then the second question is, what's your next book?
Okay. So the stories that really stand out to me, I think, are the stories of the split brain people, the people who had their corpus callosum cut, because some of the behaviors that they would show, I won't really get into it, but some of the behaviors they showed with basically their right and left brains working completely independently inside one head just blew my mind, that you could be, people basically were doing things with one hand that they didn't realize they were doing, just really incredible stories of how the mind really can kind of get split like that. So those stories are the ones that stand out, the split brain patients, I think. Next book, I'm talking with my editor about it right now, so hopefully we'll have something soon, but we're still kind of bandying ideas around, so sorry.
I wanted to know if you noticed any gender differences with similar types of issues.
Any gender differences? I didn't look at that a whole lot in the book. So there was no one section where I was talking about gender differences. And I'm trying to think of if any cases came up. Nothing comes to mind about where they really found, you know, profound differences between men and women. I think partly because the differences just between individual people are so big within the brain. One of the facts that sort of startled me when I was doing research is, you know, you see sort of the Platonic brain with different areas mapped out, that this is a language spot, this is a memory spot. But brains actually vary as much as faces do. So sometimes they're bigger in other people, just like some people have bigger noses. Sometimes they're shifted left or right, things like that. So I was surprised about the individual differences within the brain from person to person, but I didn't really get into anything, and no stories pop out about male-female differences. Any other questions? No? Okay, well, thank you again.
The human brain contains 100 billion neurons and 100 trillion synapses. Physicist Neil deGrasse Tyson summed up its complexity well when he wrote, "Everything we do, every thought we've ever had, is produced by the human brain. But exactly how it operates remains one of the biggest unsolved mysteries. And it seems the more we probe its secrets, the more surprises we find." If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find more unsurprisingly good ones on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. Thanks again to Ayan Sheikh for this recording, and thank you. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
Support for KUOW comes from Brilliant Earth, committed to environmental and social responsibility with conflict-free diamond engagement rings, wedding rings, and vintage fine jewelry. Online at brilliantearth.com. 94.9 KUOW, it's 10 o'clock.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.